Welcome to episode 4 of season 2 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 11th of May 2009 and I'm Tony. With me this week are Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
Not bad at all.
Cool. Yeah. What have you been up to this week?
I have had my first contribution to Debian and Ubuntu in the form of a patch accepted.
Congratulations. What was the patch to?
It was a patch to a program that fails when you're... it's a little command line app that tells you the bandwidth, the traffic on an Ethernet port or whatever. Okay. And it fails if your device name is longer than 6 characters, which if you have VMware or VirtualBox installed, yeah, you will have long device names.
Yeah, okay.
So it was a one-line change. In fact, it was a 2-character change to the thing.
Does it now crash if they are 6 or 7 characters?
20.
20? Is a random arbitrary 20?
No, it's not. That's the limit in the kernel.
Oh, right. Okay.
That's stupid.
Okay, and Dave's here as well. What have you been up to?
Hello, Tony. I've done a few things this week, but you've put me on the spot again. I had an interview with one of the bloggers for the Daily Telegraph.
Oh, right.
Dan wrote about us before.
And he wanted to know about the Ubuntu community and things like that, so okay, I had to talk to him.
Was this in your capacity as Ubuntu UK loco point of contact?
I hope so.
Okay. Otherwise, you've just been spreading lots of lies and misinformation.
Yes. And one of the other things is something I'm sporting on top of my laptop at the moment.
Is
a little character that waves his wings and flashes lights every time someone downloads an episode.
Okay, yeah. And speaking of characters who wave their wings and flash their lights, Simon's here.
Yeah, I've disconnected it. Many things annoy me.
Well, when you get as many downloads as we do, it goes off all the time.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Have you been doing anything interesting this week, Simon?
Well, apart from being grumpy, apparently. Hopefully. Thanks, mate. I've just been doing some more command line stuff.
You've been getting into that command line food thing, haven't you?
Yeah.
I've been learning from you.
That's
loads
great
of stuff.
The joys of the RSS feed. I can't remember. A couple of good ones. But I've been playing with Screen and Screen Profiles, which has been renamed. Is it Byobu?
Byobu?
So it's BYOBU.
Right.
So that's quite useful.
For the Welsh people, Byobu.
No, the name actually comes from Oriental's dressing screens, doesn't it? So the idea is it's a screen.
So if you Google for it, you won't get anything to do with Linux. Japanese screens all over the place.
Give it a week.
It's actually quite useful. Lots of things that it will tell you about your system, be it your laptop, your desktop, or your server. In fact, I have a bit of a panic on my server in that I installed the Screen Profiles, and it told me that my VPS was working its arse off. So a little bit of help from the guys to tune Apache down. Well, it's still
that's good.
Quite hard.
But you wouldn't have known about
it. I wouldn't have known about it. So do I really need to worry about it? But I know that's another seg entirely.
Okay, cool. And what have I been doing this week? I suppose I ask myself that question.
Someone else could ask you that.
Tony,
we could just wait for you to ask
yourself. Stand on ceremony.
Tony, what have you been doing this week?
Not much, to be honest. The main thing that I've been doing was having a meal in the dark. Nothing to do with Ubuntu, but it's the thing that sticks out in my mind.
The electricity bill or something?
It was Laura's birthday last week. Yay. And so we went out to a restaurant called Don Le Noir in...
famous German restaurant, isn't it?
Yes, that famous German restaurant in London. And it's completely in the dark.
They feed you anything.
They fed me something. It could have been anything, to be honest.
Oh, seriously?
It's totally dark. The waiters are blind.
Seriously? Yeah, really blind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's not funny.
The front part of the restaurant there's light, and then when your time comes for you to go through, they sort of lead you down a darkened corridor, and they take you to this room where you go through two layers of velvet curtains, and it's totally pitch black. There was one thing I could see, which was like an LED, which must have been on a smoke alarm or something.
Right.
But that was it, and it was very, very, very strange. And then they put the food down in front of you, and you had to sort of pre-order before you go in, but you don't know what you're eating. You just choose from a
how do you not like knock your food off your plate?
Well, that's the thing, and that's the whole experience. Is about
that's a good thing.
Well, it's an interesting thing.
I have difficulty keeping food on my plate in the light.
Exactly, and you know it's good because if you spill stuff down you don't see
until you step outside and everyone else thinks you're an idiot.
But it was really interesting, and the food was good, but it was sort of quite thought provoking afterwards about how you ended up communicating, because we were there with a small group of us, and you have to. Well, it's kind of almost a bit like a podcast, because if I point at somebody and talk to them, I've got an eye contact with them and they know who I'm talking to, but people listening don't. So I would have to say, Dave, what do you think about this, that, or the other, whatever. So you had to do that in the dark as well.
But what would you do if you had two Daves?
Well, you have to have some sort of code. Beardy Dave and non-beardy Dave.
Okay.
How bizarre.
Yeah, but it was good fun.
Did you take any photos?
No, you're not allowed. And everybody's blinded.
I bet that it's really industrial design. It's just a warehouse with brick walls.
It could be. It could be. And the glasses were not like dainty wine glasses. They were quite solid because obviously they get knocked over. And
they're buckets, weren't they?
Yeah. But no, it was very good. And if you're after an interesting dining experience, go to that.
Now, would you say it's more interesting or less interesting than the caveman one we went to in Prague at UDS?
Ah, now that was... It was a very different experience. There was less drumming going on at the one.
And less women going, ugh!
Going, ugh! Yeah, that was also... You know when Barack Obama was in Prague? And there were news reports saying, and President Obama has gone out for a romantic meal with his wife, Michelle. And I just pictured them in this caveman restaurant going, and banging on the drum with the performers in the restaurant. I think that would be fantastic.
Fan.
Oh, wonderful.
So what have we got coming up in this episode then?
It seems such a long time ago now, I can't remember. We're going to talk about your favourite Firefox extensions.
We'll have the good old news and events.
We'll have an interview with Matt Griffin and Stuart Langridge from the Ubuntu One project.
We've got a competition.
We're going to talk about the Ecosphere.
Yay.
And some feedback.
And then we'll say goodbye.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Does it?
Gotta get in before you did. On the Surrey Lug mailing list recently, and at the meeting, they had a chat about favourite Firefox extensions. And... loads of people emailed into the mailing list and said what their favourite Firefox extensions were, and it just kind of got me thinking what you guys use in Firefox.
The first one that springs to mind for me is FlashBlock.
Yeah.
Me too.
I use that.
Brilliant.
Too.
Yeah.
And then when you click on it, it still doesn't work because it's actually firing up the free Flash, so the Flash stuff doesn't work anyway for me.
Oh, do you not use Adobe Flash?
No.
What do you use?
So I effectively block Flash in two ways. One by using FlashBlock and a second by using a Flash player that doesn't play anything.
Doesn't SwiftDeck automatically block if you choose that option?
Oh, possibly. I don't use SwiftDeck. But yeah, it is useful because it means the pages load a lot quicker.
Yep. Yeah, no adverts and stupid flashy banners.
Yeah.
Cool. What about you, Son?
FireGPG. That's the main one.
Oh, you told me about that. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, because I use Gmail.
Yes,
and when I started, I didn't really use it. I mean, I've dabbled with using PGP for emails and stuff, but it was only when I got the VPS and started getting information that I really didn't want anybody else to see that I need to find a solution. And FireGPG just works. It's great.
So is it a Gmail GPG client for Gmail?
Yeah,
right. Kind of.
Okay.
The only problem I have with it is I'm often doing my email offline, so I use offline Gmail, and I'm connected to the net via 3G.
Right.
And if I'm sat on a train and I open up an email thread and there's like 10 people in that thread who've all signed their mails.
Yeah, that's a new feature. It tries to grab everybody's signature.
It does, yeah. And then there's like multiple OK boxes coming up. But yeah, other than
that,
it's
really
good.
Just get all the keys and then it won't do it anymore.
Well, no, I just disabled it. I just fixed it.
Well, no.
Web of trust, eh? Web of trust.
Dave? What's your favourite one?
Firebug is one I'm actually quite a fan of. It's a debugger for actual websites. So what you can actually do is actually edit websites on the fly.
Is that similar to the web developer extension?
No, that's more, isn't it like GreaseMonkey kind of thing?
Yeah, but GreaseMonkey you more run actual scripts that you get. Whereas Firebug, you can actually change the content of a page you're looking at.
Why would you do that?
Interesting question. It is actually quite useful in a similar field to the web developer one, insofar as when you're actually trying to develop a website and things you can quickly make changes. So it's basically, you know, a similar
dynamically
sort of,
editing the page.
Yeah, and you're actually using Firefox as if almost a replacement for Dreamweaver, if you like, or something. So that's quite
handy. What's wrong with Notepad?
A word.
Because you're not actually previewing it. What happens is when you actually press enter.
Such a wind up.
You press enter and the
change. But you load it into Firefox and go F5. Change it. F5.
Why don't you just use the GPG command line client and then copy and paste the output into your browser?
He has a point then. He has a point.
Well done. Right. Okay. Has anybody got any least favourite extensions? My one at the moment, I kind of love it but hate it, is Download Helper. Which is great for downloading sort of embedded media clips and things in web pages, but it does two things that really annoy me. One is that after it updates itself, it automatically opens up a new web page with its latest website download information screen, which just annoys me because it's taking over my browser. And the second thing is the icon sits in the toolbar and spins whenever there is a downloadable media item embedded within a particular page, and just sits and spins around. It's not. It's annoying. It's distracting. It's something moving on your screen that is distracting your eye. It's the whole reason I flash block, is to block things that move randomly on my screen.
You're going
to
hate Ubuntu One.
Oh, the icon is a little spinny. Yeah,
is it?
It's a little spinny Ubuntu logo and two little clouds.
You know what I love about iFolder? Static icon.
That's the best feature. Yeah, best feature.
I mean, static service.
And
static
another
icon.
One I'm quite a big fan of is user agent switcher. Now, now a user agent is basically what the browser's called. When it goes and downloads a web page, that's what it tells the web server the actual client is. So, for example, Firefox. I mean, it gives a bit more information. But what you can actually do with this plugin is you can actually pretend to be any browser you possibly want. You can pretend to be Internet Explorer. You can pretend to be Chrome, even an iPhone. You know, you can pretend to be anything you want.
Is there still websites that tell you can't use them if you're using the wrong browser? I mean, banking sites used to do it a few years ago, but I think
there are. The cool hack that I saw someone use that for was to change your browser so that it identifies itself as Googlebot, because a lot of websites let Googlebot through to be able to spider their site, you could browse through someone's site without logging in.
I did that. I pretended to be the Google browser, the Googlebot, and actually go to Google. Yeah, and I was hoping the internet would explode, but it didn't. I thought,
too much time.
I thought the Google bot indexing itself.
A network designed to withstand a nuclear attack is brought down by Dave in 5 minutes. What have the wonderful world of Twitter and Identica been saying about Firefox plugins?
Dave 1022 on the Twitter says stumble upon, which is fantastic. It's I use that actually when I'm really bored. You sign up for StumbleUpon, you put the toolbar in, and you get this little stumble button. And when you're bored and you've got nothing else to do, you just hit the stumble button, and it takes you to an inverted commas random web page, but it's not random because it's based on your profile and other things you've said you like or dislike. And so I often get sent to top 10 extensions for Firefox and top 10 things you should do with Ubuntu and stuff like that. You know, but no, you do get sent to like Flash games, which Kay Tony won't like.
I'm trying to get off my son's web browser.
What? Stumble upon?
Stumble upon.
That's fantastic.
No. He just sits there and goes, click, stumble, stumble. Stumble. Oh, and look, it's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. God. It's fantastic. No. But you have to use the I like and I dislike buttons as well, if you really like it. If you ever see me paste some random URL in IRC, it's because I just hit stumble upon and found it. That's why.
I've seen you place some very random URLs in IRC. Matt B90, again, Twitter names being not designed to read out, says that he loves the Twitter Fox for Twittering, and the Live Click, which is great for enhancing live bookmarks, which are sort of RSS feed bookmarks, aren't they?
Speaking of bookmarks, do you guys use bookmarks? Do you actually have bookmarks in your browser and like in folders and stuff?
I add them, but I rarely retrieve them, but I do add them.
Yeah, I do, actually. I use quite a few, but it's annoying that I've got many different systems. So
you can merge them. You can keep them synchronized by FTP in other ways.
There's an extension to do that.
Yeah, but you have to pass them all up to
your VPS via FTP
or HTTP, DAV or whatever. Yeah. So, yeah. That's good. We come around full circle there.
Excellent.
I was just going to say, I don't use bookmarks at all. All my browsers have no bookmarks in them at all.
I used to, but I just can't remember the last time I needed to.
It's Google Foo. That's the thing you need. Or your favourite search engine.
And a private wiki.
Yes.
I bet you've got links in your private wiki or Tomboy notes.
I do. Yeah. Actually, I have a Google Doc with a load of links.
Right.
In. Yeah, okay. That's my bookmark.
Yeah. Some things need bookmarking.
Yes.
JK Black said Adblock Plus. He says it's invaluable.
Totally.
And that, I think that's the one for actually blocking adverts. And it's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. It's brilliant. I love it. In fact, I went on a machine that didn't have Adblock. Oh, that was it. I was using Google Chrome, which doesn't have extensions to block adverts. Well, it wouldn't, would it? You know, Google advertising and stuff. And it was horrible. Browsing the web with adverts.
Well, see, I've got a rather technical solution to a simple problem. I actually spoof the DNS for like the common advert, like double click is one, isn't it?
So you what, edit your host's file? Or?
No, I do that at my my DNS server. So it actually gives out a different IP address to my local network.
Right. So you never see adverts without any extensions?
Depends whether what server they're on, but a lot of the common ones I block, yeah.
But keeping up to date is the trouble with doing something like that, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, they move out.
Whereas Adblock Plus takes away all that problem for you.
Yeah. Right, also from Twitter, Cowjuice says, he's a great name, brilliant. It's all text, which enables you to edit text areas using an external editor.
Oh, that's superb.
Is that
So? For example, you know, you're in a browser and you're typing an email in the text area is the name of the box that you type in, mm-hmm. and the browser goes pop. You lose what you typed in.
Sure.
With this, yeah, it opens in an external editor like Vi, for example, or whatever your favorite text editor is.
But what happens if Vi goes pop?
Vi crash.
Okay.
Or heathen.
Your favorite. And what's wrong with copy and paste?
Well, this is less effort. You know, what's wrong with blocking it all your adverts at the DNS server?
What's wrong?
This is easier.
What's wrong with editing text files with sed?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I would really, if anyone knows of a extension or add-on, whatever they're calling them these days, I would really like one to be able to archive web pages. Because there's web pages that you know are probably going to go offline within the next month or so. I mean, yeah, in Firefox you can press save as, but you lose it a bit, don't you?
Well, somebody, and I'm not sure whether it's Cowjuice or somebody else, has suggested Fireshot, which creates screenshots of web pages with a set... Alan has suggested Fireshot, which creates screenshots of web pages with a set of editing and annotation tools.
Yeah, you press the button, and it takes a screenshot of... Because you know how if you want to take a screenshot of a whole web page, you might have to page down 3 or 4 times.
Oh, right,
it does that.
It's a long page.
Yeah, it takes a screenshot of the entire document, however long it is. But that's a screenshot, it's a picture. So it's not a piece of text that you could copy and paste, like, you know.
Isn't there a web-based archive?
Archive.org.
Yeah. Ran into that one.
I've heard it.
Why, yes, there is.
I'm going home now.
The Wayback Machine.
That's the one.
That's the one, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It only kind of gets sort of once every couple of months, if that, on some sites. So it's a bit hit and miss as well.
They're actually running Ubuntu, aren't they?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, archive.org is supposed to be running Ubuntu on their service. Yeah.
Actually,
there was a news article back in season one, wasn't there?
I cringe whenever I go to my own website on archive.org. Now? Yeah, last week it looked awful, yes.
So what's your web? So what you do is, what do you type in to go to that? Would you go to archive.org, click Wayback Machine, then type in popey.com?
Yeah.
Is that what you would otherwise do?
No.
We won't put a link
edit
to
this
it
out.
In the show notes.
Okay. You really want it out? Yeah,
that's the rules. Okay. Well, if you've got a favorite Firefox, go on.
Before you go on, Google Gears. What do we think about Google Gears? That's a Firefox extension, isn't it?
Yes, and it's very useful. I use it all the time.
Never heard of it.
It's the thing that lets you do offline Gmail.
Never used it.
Oh, click offline in the top right-hand corner when you're in Gmail, and it will download Google Gears that lets you use web pages.
But it's also like
being
a way
online.
I mean, Google's slogan is, these are the gears that power the tubes. Yeah. And I think it's like an offline caching way as well. You can use it for like WordPress as well and other things.
Yeah, and Remember the Milk uses it as well. There's a few sites that use it.
Okay, there's been a suggestion from... Laura for an extension called Itarazi, which is a personal web archive allowing you to snapshot exact copies of web pages that will be there forever. Oh. Pages are kept in your secure account where they can be searched, shared via email, and published via RSS or a widget. Google is our friend, apparently. Thank you, Laura. We're busy talking on a podcast. You're the one who's got time to sit and look and Google things up.
That would be, if you can take pages and email them, then Richard Stallman
would be very happy with that.
For those that don't know, apparently that's Richard Stallman's favourite way of web browsing is to get it by email.
Well, if you've got a Firefox extension that we haven't covered and you'd like to tell us about that you're absolutely in love with, then send your email to podcast@ubuntu-uk or get in contact via one of the other ways that we'll talk about at the end of the show.
And add a .org to the end of that email address that Tony messed up nicely. Yeah.
Sorry.
Right, the developers of two popular Firefox extensions, NoScript and Adblock Plus, have been criticised for releasing new versions of their plugins which interfere with the operations of the other. The argument started after Adblock Plus blocked the adverts on the NoScript website. And the NoScript developer, who funds the project from advertising revenue, took steps to bypass the block. Order went downhill from there. I got a bit
nasty
over the top, yeah. And eventually ended up with a NoScript release, which actively interfered with the Adblock. Adblock Plus extension.
Yeah, I think he's back down now, and he's written a blog post that kind of apologises and says I did something stupid.
But it's shown how the internals of Firefox really don't have any sandboxing between the extensions. Yeah. One extension can do pretty much anything to the browser, and that includes any other extension.
Yeah, screwing around with the other extensions. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see if these plugins were signed by Firefox.
No, they're not.
No, some of them are, aren't they? If you get
You get them straight from Mozilla.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Special ones.
Because, I mean, that would be really bad.
Which implies some sort of QA process, doesn't it?
Implies, yes. The technology editor of the major British newspaper, The Guardian, recently mentioned that they have switched over 1,000 corporate users from MS Office for Mac in favour of OpenOffice.org.
That's really good.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
I mean, they're still using Mac OS, presumably.
And I think they're also using Google documents.
Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah, Google for domain things. So it's not completely solid, you know, everywhere. At the Eurocrypt conference earlier this month, a small group of researchers announced a fairly serious attack against the SHA-1 digest algorithm, which is used in many crypto systems, including OpenPGP. Security experts recommend migrating PGP keys to something from the SHA-2 family. So this would be why loads of people have been blogging, I've changed my key.
Yeah.
I've seen enough of those now.
It can stop. It's also one of these very deeply technical things that you need a degree in something very clever to work out.
I was going to say, wasn't there also a recent security event where a prominent Russian security company said, we're the only people that can hack PGP, and the way they did it was by brute force?
Yeah, and they got their stand shut down at the event. Yeah. I heard about that.
Yeah. Nice.
So do we need to be worried about this? Have I got to go and redo mine now?
Yeah, my main worry is that the checksums we do for the podcast are SHA-1. So somebody could potentially, you know, pretend to be us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you know, people, we need to re-release them.
Yeah, off you go and do it.
Listeners eager to avoid shelling out for the Microsoft Windows license that comes bundled with almost every new computer might like to know that the Open Learning Center have launched the Naked Computers website. Not quite as exciting as it sounds. An index of computer hardware retailers who sell computers without an operating system.
Yeah, this came out just a couple of days ago after we were having a conversation on IRC, and Alan Bell from Naked Computer, from Open Learning Center, said, is there a list somewhere of vendors? And I suggested he makes a wiki page, you know, on Ubuntu Wiki, call it Naked Computers. And he went, oh, I like that idea. And a few minutes later, the domain was registered and the site was up.
So we've got you to blame for this, haven't we? Okay.
Well, at least in part.
So does that mean that you can buy a computer and get no operating system with it whatsoever?
Yep.
And then you can install, you have a free choice of installing the Windows, Mac, or any other?
Yep.
And presumably you can then install the human calendar on Ubuntu.
To make it more naked.
Yeah. More naked computers.
Debian appears to be switching to the EGL IBC.
EGLib, I think.
EGLibC.
All
right. Yeah. From the ancient GLibC libraries. Embedded developers, in particular, have had a difficult relationship with the main GLibC maintainer. The question is now whether Ubuntu will adopt EGLibC too.
Mm. It's exciting times.
It's not a very exciting thing, but on the other hand, it's got a lot of implications because the two libraries are not entirely 100% compatible.
Oh, really?
So other applications may have to be changed, yeah.
Isn't this mostly happening because they don't get on? There's a bit of conflict.
It's people rather than software and technology, I think.
Oh, dear.
Community manager when you need him.
See, I mean, that's a completely wrong reason to switch. It's because of social fallout, I think, really.
Yeah, but a lot of management is just getting people to do what you want, not getting software and technology to do what you want.
A research project by Google has found that 45% of visitors hitting its web servers are not running the latest versions of their chosen web browser, 21 days after the release of an update. The report shows that 85% of Firefox users had updated against a paltry 24% of Opera users. Google's own browser, Chrome, had a 97% update rate, which is unsurprising given its silent update feature.
Yeah. You go to check to see if it's up to date, and it is, always. because it just does itself in the background.
I'm not sure I like that.
Should Firefox have something similar?
Well, we do have Update Manager, don't we?
Yeah.
And certainly on Windows.
Which pops up in the background. So we kind of have it.
Which may or may not appear at some point. But on Windows, Firefox has got a thing saying, there's a new version.
But Google Chrome doesn't even do that. It just does it.
Can you disable that, do you know?
I don't know, actually. Well, you probably can, because the Google Software Updater is the tool that does the updates for any Google software. And I guess you could block that or, you know, kill it in some way.
But are we going to get the latest version anyway? Because we've got to rely on the packager to actually get the latest one, package it, and then release it as well. So we're never going to...
Which is usually pretty quick for Ubuntu. You know, in fact, the most recent update to Firefox was... They all came out at the same time because it was embargoed. And they all came out straight away because it was all prepped and ready. And then when the security announcement came out, bam, everyone got the version at the same time.
Yeah, I think quite often what we find is rather than the update actually changing itself, is it's cherry-picked for just the actual security fix rather than a whole update in itself.
I've been at a conference all day today, and when I got here to record the podcast this evening, everybody was talking about Ubuntu One. Now, because I was at a conference, I have no idea what Ubuntu One is, but Alan has managed to rope in Stuart and Matt from Canonical to talk to us about it. Now, Stuart, we talked to you at UDS back in December, and we asked you what you did for Canonical, and you said web services, and we said, what does that mean? And you said, I could tell you, but I would have to kill you. So presumably you can now tell us a bit more without killing us.
Well, is killing you still an option?
It might well be by the end of the interview, yes.
I'll do it.
Yes, absolutely. We can now talk a little bit more about what we've been doing on the Ubuntu One team. For a start, we are Ubuntu One, a set of online services for Ubuntu and for Ubuntu users.
Okay, what does that mean in real terms?
What we've put out today is a beta of our first service, which is file sharing and file synchronization. You can store files on your desktop. They all appear through our web interface as well. They appear on your other desktops. So any files that you want backed up or made available on all of your machines happen. They get switched in between all of your different machines without you having to do any work.
So that's the direct comparison is basically Dropbox.
You're not the first person to make that comparison, certainly.
Okay, so Matt, why was it this feature that you decided to go with first as opposed to any other service?
I think this feature is actually something that a lot of people have had experience with. You mentioned Dropbox, and there's quite a few other companies that are offering this online storage, online sharing, really simple ways of doing that, and some that are offering synchronization across your all your different computers. But we saw some really great opportunities to do it, but do it in a way that is unique to Ubuntu. So you'll see some things in there that the beta users will see really easy ways to share from Nautilus, for example, that aren't there in some of the other solutions by some of the other providers. And this is just kind of the first service that we're launching, and there will be other services all kind of along with the same theme of sharing things online, synchronizing things across all your different computers, and it just files and folders are just the beginning.
And so this is for Ubuntu only? I mean, it's a stupid question, but is it for Ubuntu only?
Sure. Our first target user is really the Ubuntu user, but we realize that people don't operate in a vacuum, and that friends and family, they use different operating systems, and people that work on your teams use different operating systems. So we want to be tolerant of other operating systems. We don't want to be building clients for Windows, for example, but we want to provide the tools that someone can build a Windows client if they want to, or a Mac client, or an Android client, if possible, through our tools that we provide.
But this is a commercial product, isn't it? So it's going to cost our users something to use it.
Yeah, there's a free plan as well as a paid plan, and the difference being just capacity, and then as we roll out other services in the future, there'll probably be differences between the free option and the paid option.
Okay, so can you actually just go through what you can actually do at the moment? So you install this client on you install this application on your computer, and then what can you actually do?
When you install it on your computer, then you have a new folder in your home folder called Ubuntu One, and inside of that is where you put your files that get synchronized. So these files get pushed up to our space in the cloud, and whenever you make changes to there, they automatically get pushed up there and get stored up there. We've got a web UI that is, it's our first attempt at the web UI.
Yes.
We're changing it a lot, but so that's another way where you can get to your files and folders. And then you can share with anyone, really. All you need to know is their email address, and you can share and give them read access or read and write access. And it's really easy. We're going to be improving that as well with some other stuff that Stuart's working on, and adding some new capabilities to store contacts and pick contacts beyond just the typing in some email address of the person you want to share with, as it is right now.
Okay, so sorry, Matt.
I was going to say the final step is if you have multiple machines, everything gets synchronized across your machine without you doing a thing. Just turn the computer on. If you're connected to the internet, it gets synchronized on your laptop, your desktop, wherever.
Okay, so as somebody who's looked through some of Axe code for some of the other things he's released, how secure is Ubuntu One going to be?
So the security, right now, so we use SSL, then we have kind of the typical security in place for all the servers that all the files are stored on. So it's a secure transmission of the files.
And do users need to do their own backups, or is it all kind of backed up and safely in the cloud somewhere?
It's all up in the cloud. And so, right now, since we are in beta, we ask that the beta users keep that in mind. That this is not a Google Mail beta, what it goes on for I don't know how many years. this is a beta. This is our first time out to the public, so you probably shouldn't trust really vital documents right now. But in the future, I think that it will be a secure place for those things to live.
Okay, so Stuart, which bits of this project have you been most involved with?
The stuff that I've been involved with Ubuntu One is not really the file sharing piece. I did some work on that early on, a few months ago. But the stuff I'm involved with is more about sharing things other than files.
Okay.
Nicely vague.
Yeah. Actually,
I know I'm being deliberately vague here. It's not just to annoy you.
It all helps, though.
I was hoping to ask you, actually, about for an OzCon, you actually had quite a lengthy piece about some of the interesting features that this will eventually bring. So I'm guessing at this stage you can't elaborate on what you said then?
I can't elaborate very much. What one of the big things that we're doing with Ubuntu One is making it so you can store and share all of the stuff you've got on your computer. Now, obviously, one of the big things there is files, and that's the first piece that we've put out, but there is quite a lot more still to come. There's stuff being planned, stuff being built, stuff being rolled out.
Okay, so we'll wait
a lot more about that.
So we'll wait until after, and then we'll speculate wildly about what it could be.
Well, I suspect there may be some wild speculation, yes, and as Baby says, that's what I'm talking about at OzCon. One of the things that I'm concentrating on is the APIs that we're going to make available to developers to build their own things on top of all this stuff.
Excellent. I was going to ask if you were doing mostly web UI and JavaScript stuff or back-end stuff, but so you're working on APIs rather than the UI.
I'm in different sides of it, so I'm doing little bits of everything, but primarily, me personally, I haven't been working much on the UI.
Now, people out in the wonderful world of Twitter have been asking why it's a closed beta. Now, you've explained that it is a beta, and so therefore, it's not mission critical yet. But, can people get involved with testing it out?
Yeah, actually, it's a closed beta for the purpose of us managing the infrastructure, really. Right. Something like this could just blow, you know, all of our infrastructure out of the water if we let it get wild. But it's closed, but if someone has an invitation and someone has access, they can invite anyone else they want to the service by sharing a folder with them. So it can grow as needed. So if you have a team of users and one of the users has access, that user can grant all the other team members access by just sharing a folder with each person.
For you, have you any idea how long it's going to be before you change from the beta and actually release it? There's going to be a lot of people going to be waiting for invites and not actually get them. So can you give us sort of a guesstimate as how long it's going to be before you let it open to everybody?
I don't really have any kind of a solid date on that. I think we'll have a better idea after UDS and after we get some feedback from users over the next couple of weeks. We will be pretty active in granting access to those that request access. So if you just go to ubuntu1.com and click on the plans link, you can request access, and we're actively working that list as we speak. So we're in early beta right now. We'll probably open up a little wider to more teams in the near future. And then definitely we'll be in, you know, full public launch around the time, maybe probably a little bit before Chronic.
Right. Okay.
And as Matt says, you can get an invite by being invited by someone who's already in the system. So ask your friends if they've got an Ubuntu One account. If they have, then they can invite you by just sharing something with you.
Right. I did notice that you can invite people, but at the moment you can't remove their share, can you? Is that a current bug with the current release?
Yes, that's a bug.
it's a major top for a reason.
So we were kind of struggling with, there was a bunch, a long list of things that we really wanted to improve, but we also wanted to get this out to people and get to the users as soon as possible. And there are certain trade-offs that we had to make. That would be quickly remedied, I'm sure.
So that's release early, release often. That's what we like, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
And one question that I know we're going to get asked, and that is, what's the license on the packages that we're going to be installing on our machines?
Yeah, so we're trying to be as open as possible with all the licensing. I don't know the specifics, but if you go to launchpad.net/Ubuntu1, that's kind of the umbrella project
for
all the Ubuntu One projects, and you can find out more information there. So we're trying to be, you know, as open as possible with everything, with all of the licenses of all of our software from the client to the server side.
Because
I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe the client-side packages are GPL3. I'm just looking.
Okay. Yeah, I actually had a look at the source code earlier, and I think I'd agree with that. But what really interests me is what's the server going to be? I mean, do you think there's much chance of that being open-sourced?
At the moment, we don't have a plan. We're not planning to open the server side.
Okay.
It's something that will doubtless come up more and more in discussion.
You guys are the new launch pad, then. You're going to get the same question at every conference and every phone call.
It's possible that question will come up a lot, yeah.
Dot Waffle, Matthew Walster on the Twitter has asked, and I think this is probably for you, Stuart, will Ubuntu One work with Firefox as well as Netscape?
It certainly works with Firefox, because that's what I use.
Yes.
We are off the top of my head, I don't know exactly what UI testing we've done across lots of different browsers. Certainly, I know it works in Firefox because that's what I've been using. The others, I believe, we're testing across browsers.
Does anyone still actually use Netscape these days?
I wouldn't have thought so, to be honest with you. But Netscape under the covers is just Firefox anyway.
I bet Dot Waffle uses Netscape.
Yeah.
Well,
okay, so can you just remind everybody of the URL where they can go to find the packages to try out if they've got an invite to the beta?
Yeah, the two URLs to go to really are Ubuntu1.com, and if you want to get involved with the project, and when we have our developer tools available, go to launchpad.net/Ubuntu1. and that's where everything will happen as far as the developer's tools go.
Okay, that's cool. I don't think we've got any more questions for you, so thank you for taking the time to talk to us this evening. It's been really interesting. I'm sure Ubuntu One is going to cause a lot of interest over the next few weeks. You know, the iFolder people, I'm sure, will be quivering in their boots. both of them. Okay, well, enjoy the rest of your evening, gentlemen, and thank you for coming on the show.
It's much appreciated. Thank you.
Cheers, guys. Cheers, bye.
Thanks for letting us talk. Come on.
Shall we announce the winner from last week's competition?
That would be good. Simon, what was last time's competition?
The competition was for a T-shirt.
A limited edition T-shirt.
UDS T-shirt. It's
quite limited.
And
limited size.
Unworn.
It was clean, yeah.
Yeah.
Laura put a picture of Alan and I wearing our T-shirts on the website, which, to clarify, those will not be the T-shirts that will be the prize.
Very likely.
Unless you actually want that T-shirt.
Yes, they're more exclusive.
Right, the winner was Tristan Linnell from Kent.
In the UK.
Excellent.
minimal postage. Yes, finally.
Who got the answer to the question right. The question was, where was UDS Jaunty? And we had the answers of A, Barcelona, B, Prague, C, Mountain View, and D, Cliff Richard in 1973 with congratulations. And the answer was C, Mountain View.
Well done.
And well done. Congratulations, Tristan.
Well done.
If you were listening to the podcast in season one, you would have known that because that's where we did some interviews from.
Oh, yeah.
New competition?
Yes.
Yes.
We have a new competition, and this is a special one. There's no wrong answers for this one.
Does that mean there's no silly answer either?
Well, silly answers will be accepted as well.
Okay.
We've got 10 invitations to the new Ubuntu One, we want to give those away to 10 of our listeners who come up with ideas for how they would use the Ubuntu One platform, or what they would like to see in the Ubuntu One platform.
Okay. So what do people do to enter?
Send an email to competition@ubuntu-uk.org by...
Sunday the 24th of May.
Yes, thanks for that. Sunday the 24th of May. And you can enter from anywhere. There's no geographical restriction.
Yeah.
Because the prize will be sent to you via email.
Excellent. Good luck, everybody.
In a section that we still haven't had a new name for, and I know Dave's going to get annoyed when I say this, the Ubuntu Ecosphere.
It's Ecosphere time.
Okay, so the first one on the list is another blog post from DirectX, Joe Shields, who's now a Motu.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, and was also mistakenly claimed to be a Canonical employee by the Boycott Novell people.
I thought you were going
to
say by us for a minute.
No, we wouldn't make such a faux pas. He's blogged, again, along the Mono line about the differences between Tomboy and Gnote. If you remember, we talked about Gnote being...
Yeah, somebody suggested
so the Gnote's the non-mono one, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically a rewrite of Tomboy in non-mono, C++,
C++ and GTK. Yeah.
And it's quite an interesting read, and he does rant on a little bit.
He's done a lot of work on analysing if you have all the plugins on in one application versus the plugins in the other application.
Whether you'd save space. Or...
Yeah, and memory usage.
Oh, right.
That's where he's done a lot of comparison.
Oh, because people say that mono apps are bloated and take up lots of memory.
He's done, if you have all the plugins on in each application so they are essentially feature equal, which one takes up more memory?
Right.
And I can't remember the answer on this occasion, but he's really done quite a lot of work in looking into it.
Yeah, it's an interesting post. It's worth a look.
And the next article was from M. Rooney. Do you know who M. Rooney is in real life?
No.
No, okay.
It's not Mickey Rooney.
So,
sure.
Just M. We'll just call him M. Who's been talking about trying to assess exactly how many people are using Ubuntu. And when I say exactly, I mean vaguely. By doing some statistics.
Completely unscientific, random plots.
Yeah, by trying to work out, you know, how many hits different mirrors and things are getting. And obviously, you can't collate that data centrally very easily.
The only number we've ever had from Canonical is 8 million. And that was, 18 months ago? There are 8 million, apparently.
Yeah, and it doesn't account for people who download it once and then give a CD to a friend. And it doesn't account for people behind, like, a NAT connection who appear as one IP address and might be 100 machines and might be 15 million machines.
Mm-hmm.
But he did some very hand-wavy calculations based on the popularity of Fedora.
Yes.
Who have got much more detailed statistical information, or they claim to have, and multiplying the number of hits that Fedora have, or number of users that Fedora have, which is about 14 million, by the
the relative ranking popularity on DistroWatch of Ubuntu against Fedora. So Ubuntu is 1.6 times more popular on DistroWatch than Fedora. So therefore, and he does say it is very unscientific and very hand-wavy.
So why do it?
Ubuntu's got at least 24 million users.
That's a nice number.
And Alan, when we were talking about this, turned around and said, that's wrong. There's shed loads more Ubuntu users than that.
I just don't think that proportion's right. I don't think Ubuntu has 1.6 times the number of Fedora users. I don't know what it is, but I don't think it's 1.6.
Based on your life within the Ubuntu community?
Based on the fact that I don't know anyone. Well, I know one person who runs Fedora.
Yeah.
There you go.
I know the same person.
Exactly. And there's 10 other people who know that person, and they all run either Debian or Ubuntu. Laura knows one as well.
Yeah, that's
so true. If you know someone who runs Fedora, let us know.
Yeah.
And we'll add the numbers up.
So we just need 13,998,998 people now.
And then we get 23 million Ubuntu users.
We better up the size of our inbox, I think, so we might get a few emails.
Yeah.
Vanna Magic replaces Julian Hubbard as the creative lead of the design and user experience team at Canonical.
This is Julian Hubbard, who was...
Yeah, I interviewed him at UDS Mountain View, and he was kind of leading that whole team on the design.
To much fanfare,
and, he seems like a nice guy, but I guess he's moved on already. I don't know the lady who's coming in to replace him, actually.
No.
Not met her.
She was introduced by Ken Weimer on the art list, and we'll link to that introduction, and you'll see a bit of information about her.
Apparently, VLC and X264 libs have moved from Multiverse to Universe.
Yes.
Does that mean that the codec issues are all resolved now?
Well, it seems that way, because the whole idea of Multiverse is stuff that of questionable origin.
Yeah, copyright, license or patent issues or something like that.
And now that's moved to Universe, that means the community supports it. And it's not questionable.
Right. See, I can't see how ever it was, because it's called X264, not H264. It must be absolutely fine, surely.
Yeah, it must be nothing like H264, which is part of an Apple-used codec in QuickTime, and they're not even remotely litigious in any way, shape, or form.
Do we need to refer back to the last podcast where we talked about this and the fact that it could still be a bit dodgy?
Who knows?
Good luck.
I'm not a lawyer.
Do we care?
Good luck to the Motus. We've got some feedback from the last episode, and the first one is from Bill Bolton, who writes to tell us that there was something that caught his attention in episode 2 of the current series. Someone from Canonical was in denial about the extent of Windows penetration into the netbook market. Keeping in mind, that was Chris Kenyon, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Keep in mind, this relates only to the Australian market. The same companies in different markets will have different policies. A few months ago, he wanted an Asus EPC901 with Linux, and he found a reputable supplier. He needed to delay the purchase for about 6 weeks, and then he made contact with them again and was told, basically, they haven't got any. And when he asked, well, when will you get some back in stock, he was told, we won't. Their model has been discontinued. Not a good start. He didn't believe the sales rep, so he rang Asus directly. That's some dedication there. And he said, with the exception of the 7.0 series, all the Asus EPC netbooks now run Windows XP Home. He says, it might say otherwise in catalogues, but new Linux e-netbook computers do not exist. Acer does not provide Linux with any of its offerings, nor does Dell. No one does. Do we believe that?
Well, he said that specifically for the Australian market.
This is true.
So that may well be true in his region.
Right.
But it certainly isn't true in other regions.
Yeah, I mean, we just got a Dell Mini 9 with Ubuntu.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, at work last week.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly.
And you bought an Acer Aspire not that long ago.
Yeah.
And that was in a supermarket.
Yeah.
And it ran Linux. It was just like boxed on the record counter.
Linpus.
Yes.
Of all sorts. But yeah, I can certainly believe that Windows is getting more and more of a percentage in that netbook market, because people are familiar with the interface.
Well, I think it's partly due to the fact that the first revisions of all these netbooks, the early ones, like the very first EPC was a 2 gig SSD. The next one had 4 gig with a 7-inch screen and had a 600 megahertz Celeron CPU, which is not the best thing to run XP on. And now you've got things with Intel Atoms and the new VIA chips, and these things can run XP perfectly fine.
And more importantly, 160 gig hard drives.
Yeah, or very large SSDs and plenty of RAM.
Yeah.
And so you're more likely to get XP on them because they can run it, whereas the early ones couldn't. So we were at an advantage when it was rubbish hardware, comparatively, because we can run on that.
But Bill says, never mind, he still enjoys the podcast.
Oh, that's good.
That's all right then.
James Westby's says, you mentioned that it was said that swapping Banshee for Rhythmbox would save 6 megabytes from the distribution CD. Sebastian Backer looked at the packages and discovered that this saving comes from Banshee not shipping any user documentation whatsoever. So the CD space comes at a cost.
Yeah, that was that blog post from, what's his name again? DirectX, Joe Shields, who made the case, I think, for having Banshee. That was last time.
Documentation's for wimps, anyway.
Well, you shouldn't need it. Nobody ever gave me documentation for Amazon.co.uk, and I still managed to use
it. But I do wonder how many people actually know where to look for the documentation.
That's true.
F1.
The little question mark on the icon on the toolbar. I've removed that on mine because I never click it.
No, I don't.
I don't know whether it's by design or not, but having F1 for being help is one of the most consistent things across different platforms and user interfaces that I've seen, I think.
Except for the evil proprietary software I use at work.
It's not. It's especially evil. Yeah. F1 deletes your whole system.
Deutmar from Berlin, Germany, sent us an email, and he said, I listened to your podcast, Ubuntu, Season 2, Episode 3, Partners in Crime, and have the additional comment to why one should upgrade to Jaunty. Whilst most of the programs only experience minor updates from an Intrepid to Jaunty, and some actually broke, but that's another story. One quite important upgrade was OpenOffice.org being upgraded from 2.4 to 3.0. Although the most impatient, me included, had it probably already installed via a PPA. Yeah. Some who like to play it the safe will definitely appreciate this, and which might also be the reason for them to upgrade to Jaunty. So far, I'm enjoying running Jaunty, despite the OSD not working anymore on my T42 ThinkPad, since a bad hack was taken out of the hotkey setup, but luckily this is being worked on. Enjoy the show, and very glad that you now have a tighter release schedule. And by the way, the other Ubuntu podcast cannot really match your level of funniness and sound quality and clearly pronunciation.
I have no
last
idea.
Last part added by me.
What other Ubuntu podcasts are they talking about?
I'm not sure there are any other.
No, there aren't any. Maybe we're in denial now.
If you do know of one, please email and enlighten us.
Why would we want to know?
So we can have a listen.
So OpenOffice 3, yeah, we kind of missed that out in our... Well, we said it was in there, but...
Yeah, I've forgotten about that. Maybe because I don't use it.
Isn't it got all the funky OpenGL transitions and
they're
like
broken.
That?
Oh, yeah. They have been for ages. There's an upstream bug reported on OpenOffice, and it's been broken forever.
So you get new icons.
And file formats. Better build file format support.
Oh, and doesn't it do the shading on the spreadsheet? Instead of being a black and white shading, it's now blue... if you highlight some cells, it's now a light blue highlight rather than a black and white highlight.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah. I thought,
You see, little things.
OpenOffice is not a little thing.
Well, no, but the blue thing is a little thing.
Maybe we should ask the guys at The Guardian about it. They seem to know all about it, I think.
Yeah, but they run it on a Mac. They've probably had version 3 for a couple of years.
Ed Hewitt writes to say, thanks for reading my email about G-Fire out. Sorry about making it difficult to read. No, that was just me. You don't need to apologise for that. It was just me not being able to read off a 42-inch screen 3 inches away.
Translate it from first person to third person.
And that as well, yes. He just wanted to tell us that the oldest system that he runs Linux on, remember we had that segment about old systems, he says it's a 10-year-old box with a 633 megahertz Celeron, 256 mega RAM, 7 gig hard drive, and an ATI Radeon 7000. That sounds like a netbook.
Yeah, 633.
It's not that bad. He runs 904 with the new EXT4 file system as his main box. And what's strange is that his box runs Ubuntu better with the desktop graphics 3 compiz thing enabled, maybe because the graphics card is doing all the graphics and not the CPU.
That would make sense. I mean, the ATI 7000 is not a bad card. It's certainly more than capable of doing all the little transitions and stuff.
Yeah.
I discovered something
about Compiz. There's you know, the Compiz config settings manager thing that lets you tweak all the, you know, do you want a box and all that kind of stuff? There's a new version of that called Simple CCSM. Yeah. And if you install that, it's a much lighter thing and you only get a few options. But you can get straight to it from the appearance thing. So you know where you go to appearance, visual settings, and you say, turn on the 3D thing. There's a button that takes you straight to the simple thing where you can turn the box on and off and how many desktops you have. And it's all really easy.
So you can pick and choose which effects you want enabled. Yeah.
But it's a very limited interface. It's not like the big mass that is the settings manager thing.
Can you enable the known and loved cube?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ooh. Although by default they have it as a cylinder for some reason.
A cylinder?
Yeah. I turned it all on and then had four desktops, and when I went to rotate, it span around on it looked like an oil drum.
That sounds
very bizarre.
Vomit inducing.
It was. I turned that off straight away. Yes.
And Dave, last episode you said you were going to get your old box out of the loft and install Ubuntu on it and tell us how it went. So how did it go?
Yes, that hasn't actually been done.
The word you're after is fail.
Yes, that hasn't actually been done. Hopefully for the next episode, I'm afraid.
Okay, right, okay. Well,
speaking of slow machines, actually, we have another slow machine, but we'll save that for the next episode.
Oh, yes, more slow machine fun to come.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, Sorin, I don't know whether it's Sorin Silagi, who has emailed in the show before, maybe even been a competition winner, actually. Possibly. Anyway, friend of the show, Sorin has emailed in to say he has a 550 megahertz P3 with Gen2 on it, and compiling X.org took about 2 days. And it was about the same with OpenOffice.org as well.
Oh, man.
That's not bad, actually. 2 days for, I mean,
yeah, but by
it takes
the
me that long to download it.
Yeah, but by the end of the week, and then wait another week for it to boot, you would actually have a usable desktop within 2 weeks.
Yeah, but when it gets too bad, it's like fast, man.
You know, when we were talking about these slow machines, we talked about Hugo's random benchmark on the Hanslug wiki. Well, just after the show went out, a couple of guys on IRC pinged me to say, I've added my machine to the list, and one of them appeared like fairly near the top, and the other one had a really old machine. He put his right near the bottom.
One of the things we were after was a multi-threaded version of it, because we had somebody who said that I wanted to run it on his cluster.
Yes.
Just to see how fast it was, but it's only single-threaded, so it only ran on one core at any one time. That's a shame.
I have to keep badgering Hugo about that.
And have we got any other feedback via the Twitter or the Identica? Not on this occasion. See, last time I missed that off and then I got shouted at. Oh. I was going to wrap the segment up and they were like, no, Twitter Identica. And then this time it's the wrong way around. Fail. Oh, well, thank you very much for all your feedback anyway.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who took part via Twitter and Identica. If you'd like to get hold of us, you can email the show via podcast@ubuntu-uk.org or leave 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986.
You can send us your comments on Identica via the identica.ca/UUPC or Twitter, which is twitter.com/UUPC. as well as getting updates from recording sessions.
Alternatively, if you're into IRC, then you can chat to us on the #Ubuntu-UK channel on the Freenode IRC network.
You can find us on Facebook. Look for our fan page on Facebook, searching for Ubuntu UK Podcast.
How many fans are we up to now?
I haven't checked since last time. It was 78, after the recording of the last
episode. I was going to ask if we were into two digits yet.
Producer Laura will look it up as we continue through our wrap-up.
We possibly have been depriving our Facebook audience somewhat, haven't we?
Oops.
Well, they get all the latest episode release news and things on there as well, and they can talk about the show.
Great. We welcome suggestions, material, tips, reviews, or rants and feedback, both positive and negative. So please do get in touch.
And thank you to our network of community mirrors who are listed on the website.
Yay!
They are.
Congratulations.
Are they really?
Didn't take much.
Oh. Did you actually publish the page?
Yes, he did.
Okay, right, okay. For a while there was a list, but nobody could see it. It's a strange list. We should forewarn you now that the next episode may be a bit delayed due to UDS.
Format might be different and all kinds of changes, I think.
Maybe a little bit of an unusual show.
Shake up.
But it should be good. And producer Laura has just told us how many people are on the Ubuntu UK.
84.
84 fans on Facebook. So join it and see if we can get it to 100.
85.
See if we can get it to 100 for the next episode.
Yes, we are talking to you.
Yes, we'll see you next time then. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.